Welcome to Girl Flower Podcast with Vic and Jess. We will be having conversations and inspirational chinwags with florists and growers to keep you company in your workspaces, in the car, over a cuppa, or wherever you like to listen. We hope to help you along on your own floral journey. In this week's episode, Vic and I spoke with Rachel from Green and Gorgeous. Now, I had met Rachel before and Vic hadn't, but we were both equally looking forward to chatting with her. We've both followed her for a very long time and just love her Instagram, her website, and love everything about the farm and the business that she's created. This was just a wonderful, wonderful conversation, and we really hope you enjoy.
I've been a gardener now half my life. I started really when I was about 25, and I actually landed a job with the hospitals, the NHS, designing and maintaining hospital gardens. Looking at the therapeutic benefits of those spaces for the patients and the people that visited them. And so that's the angle I actually came into it from. Even though I'd always been a plant person all my life, ever since I was a child, you know, it's the usual story. I lived with my grandmother when I was young, and she was an obsessive gardener. And so I sort of got the bug from her, I guess. But yeah, I didn't really come to it properly until I was 25. And then I started to get into garden design because the first job I was given was to design a roof garden for the maternity ward. And to be quite frank, I knew absolutely nothing. And I made a right pig's ear of it and put all the wrong plants in. And I think everything died apart from the euphorbia. So I sort of quickly realized that actually I needed some training. So I went and did a garden design 2-year course with at Pershore College, which is a great college. And my teacher was Chris Beardshaw, who's now quite a well-known garden designer. But back then he wasn't on television or anything like that, or doing Gardener's Question Time. He was just lecturing at Pershore, and he was an amazing teacher. And he really inspired me, and I did 2 years with him, and I learned so much that I sort of then had my own business doing garden design, as well as the hospitals. I was doing private gardens. But I kind of got a little bit bored of just doing ornamental, and I started to think about productive horticulture. And I wanted to actually start to do, you know, grow things that you could eat. And so I actually sort of left all that behind, all the garden design. And I went on to work as an estate gardener on this beautiful private estate in the Cotswolds in a walled kitchen garden. Mm. Yeah. I just remember the first time I walked in there, and it was sort of love at first sight. And they'd very craftily removed all the perennial weeds, so it just looked immaculate. And I thought, oh, this is going to be fine. And I didn't know anything about growing vegetables, not a thing. I'd only ever sort of sown some radishes when I was a kid. And I thought, I'll never get this job. And I came with a cottage, you know, a tiny cottage, a Cotswold stone. Yeah, it was the dream job. Unbelievably, I got the job. And they sent me on lots of courses. They trained me up. And one of them was actually with Sarah Raven. And this was back in 2002. So it was quite early on in her career as well. And that's when the seed was sown with the cut flower thing. Because not only did my job was to produce vegetables, fruits and cut flowers for the family in the manor. It was a bit Downton Abbey. Yeah. So I would sort of take all my produce on a Friday. I'd sort of take all my produce up to the big house and that knock on the back door, you know, the sort of scullery, and the housekeeper and the butler would be waiting for me and the chef, and they'd usher me in and look at the produce, and the housekeeper would fuss over the flowers. Mm. they were too short and all this sort of stuff. So so that's basically what I did for 6 years. And I think from that initial day with Sarah Raven, I just the sort of, you know, I just wanted to grow more and more cut flowers. Mm. And I did the veg. I love the veg, but the cut flowers really was where my love was, because it combined for me the ornamental that I'd, you know, bringing all those plants together in borders, which I'd done with my garden design, but then actually being able to use them and then do creative things with them and see it through. It was just absolutely spot on what I'd always been looking for. And I just knew then that I would never do anything else. That was it.
When you went down to Sarah Raven's, although you say it was early on in her career, was her garden still?
I didn't go down there. She actually came to where we were. She came and taught a course on the estate.
Okay.
So actually, that was the first time I met her, and I walked her around the walled garden and showed her all the sweet peas I was growing, and she wrote down all the varieties. but yes, that's yeah, she was doing it as a kind of charity event. Yeah. So all these ladies came and they had picnic on the lawn next to the lake. And
oh, my goodness.
She often does that, doesn't she? She sort of tours around and teaches. So I didn't actually go. I didn't go to Putchill until about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, when I went and taught there.
Okay.
Weekend, which was one of the highlights for me of my you know, cut flower growing career, if you like. Yeah,
amazing. So after so you had your 6 years.
Yeah, I had my 6 years. I had no brief. I was just told to grow what I wanted. I could spend as much money as I liked.
Oh my goodness.
You know, I could buy whatever I wanted. I had people helping me. It was a 2-acre walled garden, so it's quite a big space to fill. And sadly, the owners sold the estate.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. Why did you leave? Because it sounds like the dream.
I think I would still be there if they hadn't have done that. So maybe it's good that they did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. At that time, some land came up for rent, which is here. I heard through a friend of a friend. There was this beautiful site. It was with the Soil Association. It was all organic. The soil was really fertile because it's next to the River Thames. And it already was, it had an existing market garden. So it already had the kind of the setup, the poly, the irrigation, and it had a customer base and it was in an affluent area. So it sort of ticked all the boxes. And of course, when I heard they were going to sell, that's when it started to go in my mind, this is what I want to do. Mm. Why aren't there more people selling these flowers? Because part of my brief with the family was to sell the excess veg and fruit and flowers off. So I would do farmers markets, local farmers markets. And that's when I saw, and I'd sell a few little bunches of sweet peas. And that's when I saw how strong the demand was. Mm. The organic, you know, the slow food movement was really going by then. There were loads of good farmers markets. Everyone was really paying attention to the food, but not to the flowers at all. There was no one at any of the farmers markets selling flowers at that time. You know, we're talking when I started Green and Gorgeous, it was 2007. So I just saw the opportunity and I really believed it was the right thing to do. So when I came here, I basically started clearing all the veg out. Much to my partner's alarm. You know, we argued over that for about 3 years because he wanted to stick with the veg and I had to slowly wear him down because I just totally believed it was the right thing to do. There were lots of people doing organic box schemes already.
Mm.
So that's basically what I did. I started planting flowers where there had been cabbages.
So when you took on the plot, you say there was like the vegetable market garden bit there. And how much space did that take up and compared to how much you've got now?
Well, that was 2 acres. So it was quite nice because I was used to working with that unit of size. And that we had when we started was the 2 acre field. When I say all we had, that's still quite a lot for a lot of people, isn't it? 2 acres. But for me, it wasn't enough. I'm now up to 6 acres. So, but that was a gradual process. And it took probably at least 2 to 3 years to fill the 2 acres. It wasn't an instant thing because we didn't have the customers. We didn't have enough customers to produce. What was the point of producing 2 acres of flowers when you haven't got anyone to sell them to? Very much a kind of a sort of growing, selling, holistic approach to build the two, the supply and the demand, to build the two gradually together.
I was going to ask, sorry, didn't mean to.
No, carry on.
I was going to ask, in terms of you getting your flower growing set up, you're taking all the veg and everything out and you're planting in your flowers or however you're doing it. How long did it take you to have like established that flower garden well enough for you to be able to sell the stock? Does that happen quite quickly or?
It did happen quickly because initially the only way I was selling was farmers markets. And I was planting all through 2007. I was planning and planting mainly in the autumn of 2007 to launch the business in the spring of 2008. So when I actually came to live here in 2008, because before I'd just been working here weekends, but still keeping my job on, I had enough to go straight in to doing probably 2 farmers markets a week. We had a little Saturday farm gate, and I was also selling excess to florists.
Fantastic.
I had a few gaps. You know, you can't just expect to have a continuous supply. That's early on. I'd have like these gluts and gaps, quite badly, actually, to be quite honest. You know, like all of May, I don't think I really had any flowers. And then I had so many sweet peas. I didn't know what to do with them. I planted too many at once. So it was all of that learning curve was quite harsh, actually. But I managed. And I'd say it wasn't until probably year 3 that I was really like, okay, we've got lots of weddings now and I'm getting there. It's starting to feel less gappy, shall we say.
So when did the wedding start for you? How did you, did people start coming to you and asking, so they're asking you, can you make up a bridal bouquet or can I buy some flowers to do DIY? And I suppose it's quite organic as well, the way you've grown your business.
It is. I mean, I had never really had any intention of doing weddings. I don't see myself as a wedding florist, really. That wasn't ever my plan. But people would just come up when I was doing the market and ask. And so I just said yes, because I'd say yes to absolutely everything.
Did you, was that kind of like a skill that you learnt, or did you have any training or did you have any help?
I did. I originally did work with a florist. And so she sort of showed me what to do, even though she wasn't really that au fait with doing weddings either. We are both quite new to it, really. She'd done more kind of corporate event work before. But anyway, I definitely learned quite a lot from her. And then I suppose the only other kind of training, I don't really have never had any formal training. But I suppose I've had some really great florists come here and do courses, run courses here, the best in the business. And I've learned from them over the years, which, you know, has worked really well for me because I couldn't, in the season, I'm too busy to go off and do courses. Mm-hmm. So to have these people come here and just do a day and join in on the course was, and they love being here because they get to use all the materials. So that's one of the things where I'd say I've learned a lot from them.
And I suppose as well, like, you know, having a design back, like garden design background, and then also growing your flowers, you know those flowers, you know their tendencies, their shapes, their colors that go together. So it's supposed for you, it was just a matter of learning a little bit of technical stuff, wasn't it? A bit of construction.
It was really, no, you're right, it was learning the mechanics.
Yeah.
And I do really think you do need to learn that. And I think I at first fell down a bit because I didn't have that knowledge on the sort of installation work and things like that. So I think it's well worth doing courses, workshops. And there's so many of them now, you know, in the natural style. And there wasn't when I first started. There were no workshops that encouraged that natural style. So I just didn't want to do them. You know, I just thought I'd just do my thing.
Yeah, do your thing.
Which is quite arrogant, really, but there you go.
Well, it seems to have worked, and you know, hosting the courses where you are. So yeah. You have quite a large kind of teaching barn area, don't you?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Was that? Now I know I've been, but I can't even remember whether it's actually an old barn or a new barn that you've built. Was that always there?
No, it's a beautiful old coaching barn. Tithe barn that's been there for, I don't know, a few hundred years probably. And it was at the point of almost falling down, and it got my landlady spent a year having it completely done up and all turned into a teaching space. And that was just back in 2019, so actually,
oh wow.
Yes, to really launch in 2020. That was a bit of a godsend for us because before we were in a much smaller working space, a teaching space. So it's been very useful for the courses to be able to allow social distancing and be able to continue with them in 2020 and this year.
Wow. When do you think your courses will start back up again?
It's been so hard with the courses, you know. With the government's guidelines, I found it quite hard to make a decision on what to do there. Mm. I have now decided to run them from April the 12th. So I've shifted all the ones that I had before that date, and I've pushed them back. And so I will be going ahead from April the 12th with my courses, and I have quite a few booked. Amazing. In. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your courses and what you offer? Mm.
Yeah, so they're a real mix of both the growing side and the arranging with garden flowers. And they're aimed at both the hobby, so someone who wants to do it for fun, grow a cutting patch on their allotment or in their garden. But there's also a career sort of line to it as well, with the flower farming for beginners, which is just an introductory day to the subject. It's to sort of get people into the right way of thinking about it, I think. And then I've introduced a 3-day flower farming course, which is a bit more practical, flower farming through the seasons. So I do a day in March, a day in June, and a day in September, and people just come back. That has been really good, because then they can really see the fields at different times of the year and get up to date with what they're meant to be doing on the growing side. So it's quite a hands-on course, that one. And then, yes, I do things like masterclasses in particular plant groups. So I've got one coming up in April on tulips, because I'm a real, I just love a trial and growing loads of different varieties of things. And I've got the space and to do that. So those sorts of, like the dahlia masterclass, it's really fun for people to come and when it's dahlia time and get lots of ideas of dahlias they could grow and what's the best way of growing them for cutting and how do you design with them. So just a full day on one type of flower is really a nice thing to do as well. But I'm always introducing new ones, you know, you've got to keep it fresh. So this year I'm doing one on perennials, which I haven't actually put out there yet. I was waiting to see what was going to happen, but it'll be a perennial masterclass, because that's where my real interest is at the moment, is in perennials.
So Vic, when I went down to Rachel's farm, the dahlia were all in bloom, just rows and rows and rows of them. And in your tunnel, you had all those massive cafe au lais, and the roses were still kind of in bloom and everything kind of in colour, you know, and in strips. Honestly, it's absolutely, I could have come away with buckets of flowers. I would have cut them.
Honestly, you did actually say, you were like, I would literally drive there every single day. That is what she said before we came on here. I would drive there every day. Just to go and look at
lovely.
It.
But it's interesting that you say about your three the seasons masterclass, because that is kind of the most sensible way to start a growing career, isn't it? Understanding what the seasons did. Unlike me, you know, to have this piece of land, brilliant, I'll start planting it. You know, knowing things now, I already a few months in go, oh, I should have planted this there and I should have done this there. So that course is amazing. But I'm really interested in your perennial one, because your perennials are, you have so many, don't you?
Yeah, I'm well over 100 varieties now, and I'm adding more and more all the time. It's become a bit of an obsession, actually, the perennials. I just really think they're the way forward for a lot of us growers. You know, they make sense to me on so many levels. And I've learned the hard way, really, with climate change, growing annuals, even dahlias, even roses, has become increasingly difficult.
Mm.
I don't want to be a downer, but you know, it's got hard. It gets harder every year to do this.
Really?
Yeah, it does. The weather patterns we have. You know how we get into these very sort of prolonged, you know, either really wet, really dry, yeah. Really cold. It's very extreme. And actually, what I've found over the years, and I've had many a very bad weather incident, shall we say, flooding. Freezing down to minus 18. We're very exposed here. Terrible winds that have blown over all my plants, flowers. So I've found that the perennials can stand a lot more.
Mm.
Tough. They're the stalwarts, and they will see you through. They're your backbone that you can rely on. A lot of them don't even need to be staked. Delphiniums and peonies, yes, but most of them don't. And they just give you that sense of really reassuring. You know, you think, it's okay. I know I've got a wedding next week and I've lost all my gypsophila, but I've still got that, whatever it is, Achillea looking good, or, you know. So if you can really explore those groups and find ones that are high yielding, fast growing, and almost do a similar job in a design as an annual equivalent, you are going to give yourself so much less stress. And it's less work, isn't it? You know, they don't need the amount of jobs doing to them as an annual does.
So the one bed of yours that I was most taken by was your Lysimachia bed. You were saying about how the foliage, you even when the flowers are gone, you can use the foliage. And so I've brought some Lysimachia seeds from your seed collection, which I do sow, and I bought them because I bought some seeds from somewhere else and tried to germinate them. Not one. What's your tip? How can I make my Lysimachia grow?
It really helps to have good quality fresh seed when you're trying to grow perennials from seed. And that's one of the reasons that I'm going quite big on perennials. Well, partly because I really think they're great, but also because I don't think there's many companies out there doing good, fresh perennial seed.
Okay.
Now, if it's being a bit tricksy, it might need a chilling period.
When
seeds are being a bit slow, I will, because I've got them on a heat bench, I think, hang on a minute, maybe they don't want to be warm. Maybe they need to be cold for a while. So I'll move them into a cold frame. Or sometimes I'll keep seed packets in the freezer for a couple of weeks before I sow them. It's almost like for each seed, it has different requirements. Some want light, some don't. Some want that cold stratification. Some want to be really warm and humid. So it's quite... most of the ones that I sell are the ones that are easy. Because I don't think there's any point in me putting seeds on there that need, you know, a whole long list of different temperatures.
So I just need to get on and sew them then, don't I?
Oh, do get on and sew them. I mean, I always sew my perennials quite early. So I'll start them off in February.
Okay.
Because I'm quite keen on getting flowers in the first year if I can. And many of them are first year flowering. So, for example, things like cochlea, scabious, eryngium, they will all flower for you in the first year if you can get them sown in February. Early March, shall we say.
Yeah, come on, Jess, crack on. Get to that field. The kids are at school now. You've got no excuse.
Yes, come on.
Actually, I sowed some achillea and larkspur, which lots of people seem to have trouble with. But I sowed them back in the autumn. And I have so many plants and they are looking so healthy. I have so many that I'm thinking I'm going to have to sell some plants to people.
Yeah.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I was quite impressed with that. So, right, I'm going to go to the pot this afternoon. I'm going to sow those Lysimachia and have a bed that rivals yours.
Yeah, I mean, I think autumn sowing, there's a lot to be said for autumn sowing because, you know, larkspur particularly loves that cold spell.
Yeah.
It's dormant if it's too warm. The seed won't germinate. And that's quite a common thing. You know, amies like that. A lot of the hardy annuals are like that. And that's why it's better to sow them in the autumn.
Yeah.
Classic case. I wouldn't even bother sowing or layering in the spring. There's no point.
Well, I'm glad I've got mine. I'm glad I've got mine in. I obviously made some good decisions.
So and I think, you know, you just learn, don't you, as you go along and you sow things that work and things that one of the best things that I've done in the past few years is get some grow lights. Because I'm sowing things so early in the season, you need the grow lights so they don't get really leggy and drawn.
So what is that? They're just like a heated lamps or something?
It's not really, it gives off a bit of heat, but it's more about the amount of light it gives.
I see.
I just have those set up in the greenhouse. So I take my germinated, as soon as they've germinated in the propagator, the heated propagator, out they come and they go underneath the lights. And that gets them, you know, so they get enough light so they're not getting drawn. They just turn into lovely little stocky little strong seedlings and it pushes them on quite quickly as well, so I'm always in that kind of rush, almost
impatient grower.
I just want that flower, you know, as soon
that's
as
it.
You know, it's all about what your market is, and the fact that I'm going for weddings, I want flowers to really kick in around end of June.
Yeah,
taking, you know, perennials are really mainly July, August, you know, always a tricky time. There's often a gap, isn't there? But if you get those first year flowering perennials going, you fill that gap really nicely for your August weddings.
Yeah. Oh, goodness, this is going to be a bit of a testing year for me. Rachel, I was going to mention your seeds. So you've started this year, or was it the end of last year?
End of last year.
Selling your seeds.
Yeah.
Gorgeous plants. So how do you do that? Because and make sure that you get the right colours and things. Do things cross pollinate, or are you selling the ones that don't cross pollinate? How does that work?
So I'm going for open pollinated varieties that do not cross pollinate. So most hardy annuals don't cross pollinate. You know, sweet peas don't.
Mm.
All those kind of lovely cornflowers, Agrostemma, amies, you know, they're all scabiosa. You can save the seed and it will come true. Things, perennials, as long as they're not, you know, certain cultivars also come true from seed quite happily. I think it's when you get perhaps more into sort of half hardy annuals, that particular group like zinnias, anchorhines, a lot of those come from their F1 hybrids or they will cross-pollinate. See, you know, Nicotianas cross-pollinate, but actually some of what you get from a cross-pollination of Nicotiana is even more beautiful than the original. So, for example, something like Nicotiana Tinkerbell, I don't know if you know that one, crossed with Nicotiana Starlight Dancer, is a lovely combination. You get the best of both. So then it's quite nice to sell that as what I call a garden mix. So people are aware, or if I sell the delphiniums, it's going to be an F2, not an F1. So that what you get is going to be a sort of a mix of all those varieties. So yeah, as long as people know what they're getting, and this is just from me saving my own seed for years and growing it and seeing what happens. Mm-hmm. And on the whole, I get amazing results. And you know, the other thing that I get is much better germination. Things okay. just grow like cress when it's your own fresh seed.
Oh, that's really
so because it's adapted to your microclimate. Okay. So you almost create your own variety that likes growing in your patch if you save your own seed.
I love that.
That's really interesting. Mm. I just always assumed with seeds that, like, if you had a, you know, like delphiniums, I know that, you know, if you have a pink one, a blue one, and then you'd save the seed, you don't really know what you're going to get. And I just assumed that was across a much broader board than it obviously is. So that's brilliant to know that you can just save all your seeds. And you say sow them fresh, sow them when they would fall on the ground.
Yeah, you know, like, say, for example, something like, yeah, exactly, when they fall on the ground, when they shatter. Something like Icelandic poppies. For years, I tried to grow Icelandic poppies. Mm. Every year I buy the seed, sow it, wouldn't get very good results. And one year I did get some, and then I saved the seed from them. And I just could not believe the difference in the germination rate. I think that was a bit of a moment for me where I just thought, hang on a minute, you know, I need to do more of this.
Yeah.
And that was way back when I was working as the estate gardener. So it's worth experimenting.
Is it common practice for growers to, because obviously I don't know anything about growing, so is it common practice for growers to use their own seeds
I think actually a lot of gardeners and flower growers do save their own seed.
Yeah.
I mean, I know other flower, because I do a little seed swap with a few flower growers, and they've seen something that I've got on Instagram and they're like, oh, can I have a bit of that? And then I'll be like, well, can I have some of your, you know, your Atroplex? Yeah. And then we'll just post the seed to each other. And I think that should be encouraged, and to the point where I would love to host flower growers seed swap.
I love that.
Why not have one for flower farmers? I think that'd be fantastic, especially now because Brexit's really put a spanner in the works.
Mm.
You know, it's really difficult now to get seed in from Europe or from America or from anywhere. You know, I ordered a load of seed from America back in December, and it's been at Stansted Airport ever since. It's a nightmare.
So, you know, talking about the one that everybody will know, it's Florette. They don't even ship to the UK anymore.
No, she can't. She can't, because every time you send out seed, you have to get a phytosanitary certificate, which costs about £100.
Wow.
So who's going to do that?
No.
And it's the same now with Brexit. I can't send seed to Europe anymore, because each person that places an order would have to pay £100 on top of their order to get the seed.
No way.
Yeah, and it really annoys me, because I don't think we really knew about all of that, did we?
No, because they've got that coming in Holland as well, haven't they, with things coming over. So from, I think it's June or July, any stuff shipped over from Holland will have to go through the same process with plants.
Right.
What
about cut flowers?
I'm not sure. I know that there's going to be more things happening around June and July, that it's going to take a lot longer. I can't remember where I read it at all, but there was a mention of bigger delays, extra stuff coming in, where there's going to be big delays.
God, we all need to get growing more, Rachel, because the florists need it.
I've been talking to seed producers in other countries, well, like Erin, but also people in Holland, and it is becoming very apparent, and they're encouraging me to do more, because it's becoming very apparent that if we want the good varieties, we're going to actually have to really focus on producing them ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so that area of the business, this is just the beginning. I mean, it's really what the direction I want to move in is, starting to produce the stock, you know, for flower growers, the good stuff that I know works well as a cut flower.
Yeah. Well, your field is an absolute, you know, shining example of beautiful, healthy plants, isn't it? It's you know, you've
well, not always.
Well, okay, from what I bless saw, you. It was lovely. It was lovely. And I'm sure there are disasters. I know you were talking about having to dig up some beds and beds of dahlia because of, is it crown gall? And that's to do with the dryness, is it?
Yeah, there's been a lot of crown gall virus. But last year for me, the real problem was red spider mite. Now,
that was
usually a polytunnel or greenhouse pest. But I found in the past 3 years where we've had these much drier summers, it's actually even become a problem outside for me. I don't expect it has for everyone in the country. I think we're just quite dry here. But that is a nightmare pest. It really is. And it's so hard to get rid of. It's probably about the worst thing you can have on your dahlias, to be honest with you.
Because you were going to be digging up.
I had to throw away all of my cafe lays.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is a bit gutting. And then I'm going to go back to Brexit again, just briefly. where I normally get my dahlia tubers from is Holland, and they stopped shipping to the UK. So then I was a bit stuffed. Oh, get them from those guys as usual. And oh, no more. So there we are again.
Oh my goodness, that'll be the next thing you need to do, your seeds and then your dahlias. You'll be taking cuttings from all of them and getting them going and splitting them.
Yeah, well, it's that makes you think, actually, I do need to hang on to my tubers. Maybe not if they've got red spider mite, because the thing is, red spider mite will go and overwinter down in all the cracks and crevices of your tubers. And if you get another warm, dry, you know, summer, then you will have a real problem. They'll just be back onto the plants. Yeah.
So that's a case of dig up and burn then, isn't it?
Well, I felt it was. I think you just can't, when it's about making money from the flowers, it's different, isn't it, from just being a gardener and thinking, oh, well, you know, it's only one or two, never mind. It's different. You can't afford to take the risk, especially with such a profitable flower as a cafe au lait.
Yeah. So could you talk a little bit about kind of the structure of how everything works in your business? So you've got lots of different things that you do. So you've got your kind of pick your own kind of DIY brides. Then you've got you as the wedding florist. Mm-hmm. You've got selling to florists, like a wedding.
Yeah,
event florist.
I don't actually. Do you know, I don't really sell to florists that much, but I'm hoping that will change. I've been doing weddings now for 13 years, and I'm kind of wanting to finish doing that. I think next year will be my last year, for sure. In fact, I wish it was this year, to be quite honest, because I really want to wind that down, and I would then move into selling to other to florists. It's just at the moment it's too difficult for me because I'm doing so many of my own weddings. It's just a head fry to try and work out what I want, what they need. So I just don't. But I would like to move that across. And then we have a farm gate on a Saturday, which is very busy. It's become increasingly busy to the point where it's one of the most important parts of our business now, Saturdays. Where people just come along, we have lots and lots of flowers picked. It looks like a beautiful florist's, all in buckets, conditioned. But we also offer a little bit of pick your own on the Saturday as well. Just daily sweet peas followed by dahlias. Then on the courses, we do a bit more where people can just go and pick a bucket of what they want. I do one-to-one consultations. What else do I do? Gosh, and now the seeds as well. But yeah, weddings, I mean, I'll do on average about 50 weddings a year.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot when you're a grower, you hold courses, you've got to pick your own. Are you have a partner in the business, but do you have a kind of all-round team that help you with all of that?
So, it's me and my partner, Ashley, and we live here on site. We work, obviously, very full time. But we have a seasonal part time team that come in. I mean, we have 2 days two people a day coming in and helping us with all the growing. And actually at the moment, I need more help with the floristry. So I've got my growing team really sorted. But last year, sadly, because all the weddings were off, I lost my florists. And now I need to find some new people to come and help with the wedding work and my Saturday, because on Saturdays we're just making up bouquets all day in the shop.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be hiring over the next couple of weeks. I'm going to start to look for someone or two people. Yeah.
Amazing. And
so, team.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason you're sort of knocking weddings on the head, is that because you do want to focus on, obviously you're growing more, and also all these other things that you'd like to do, like you said, making more of a community of being able to give out tools for your fellow growers, more of a kind of hub where they can.
Yeah, you know. I just, you know, my love is in teaching and finding all the best varieties for cutting. I'm actually starting to write a book this year as well.
I
know.
Exciting.
So you know, I've got a lot going on, and I do really want to supply flowers to other florists now. I actually think now is really the right time for me to do that. That's really where my interest is. And I have to say that I think I've done my time with the weddings. Mm. It's time now, you know, to change it again.
Yeah, it's time to give those other florists a go with those flowers. I was saying to Jess, I was like,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, no, I'm well up for that. If I can just have that space, that headspace to do it, I think it would be fantastic. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Are you starting to, obviously you are starting to see things changing because you're planning on opening your courses up. But are you kind of noticing more people getting in touch about courses and flowers? And you're not doing the farm gate sales, are you? You're doing ordering online and collection at the moment. Is that right?
I mean, obviously with Mother's Day this weekend, that's going to be delivery.
Yeah.
But I will be opening the shop after the 12th of April. So that first Saturday after, that's when we open. And we'll just go on from there. I'm using that as my date. And then all my weddings have been, I expect you found this as well, that all the weddings have been squished up. They've all been, for me, you know, I thought people would still perhaps go for the intimate wedding.
Yeah.
But they haven't.
No.
When they can see, if you found this, like, oh, actually, I don't have to just have 30. I can have 150 or whatever it is if I just wait till after June.
Yeah.
So they've all just gone, right, what have you got for me after the 21st of June?
Yeah, I've even got somebody who was, is it the 21st it will change, or the 22nd? When is it? Yeah, so the
22nd.
21st. So she's holding for the 21st, but she's just in case it all doesn't happen. And then she's provisionally booked me for the 22nd in case it does happen. She might have a micro wedding on the 21st, but if it all opens up, then the 22nd she'll have a big wedding. And also she's provisionally booked the date in 2022 with me as well, just in case. So it's all carnage, because everything was May was mental, and May and beginning of June was absolutely mental. I had like 5 or 6 weddings in 1 week, and I was like, oh my god, how am I gonna get them done? And then all of a sudden everyone goes pew, pew, pew.
Yeah.
Off into the sunset. And I was like, where have my bookings gone? You know, but it's mad. It's mad.
It's been really, I mean, I've actually lost 7 weddings because of them all moving and double booking. I've had to actually go to 7 quite big weddings.
Oh, what a shame.
Which, you know, I guess it was always going to catch up with us at some point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You can't help everybody. You can do absolute best, but the positive thing for the people that you are having to, you know, put to side is they will find somebody else, because there's all these florists that we're all kind of like, we haven't had any work for such a long time. So yes.
I'm sure they will.
It is a shame though, isn't it? It really is a shame that you can't get to do those.
I know.
There's only so much you can do. There's only so much you can do.
So frustrating.
Yeah.
But then I think, well, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
just got to make the best of it, haven't you? And things will gradually even out.
They will.
So
throughout last year, with stop start with courses and things, and you know, lockdown. How did you cope? Did you manage to shift all your flowers?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. I think in many ways I sold more flowers. I certainly did in the spring because I was doing my doorstep buckets, which was so popular. I pretty much introduced that a week after we went into lockdown. So I was
straight on it.
Well, I didn't really have any choice because the flowers were ready. The flowers are my lead, you know.
Yeah.
Can't wait. And so I just went for it. And I think I picked more. I found that actually doing bouquets and making up bouquets and doing these buckets of flowers uses more flowers than weddings. It's quite interesting, actually. I learned so much last year and I really loved changing pace and trying different things. You see, that's what I thrive on. I get bored quite easily, so I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed working in different colour palettes, brighter colours. I think we all had that, didn't we?
And yeah, definitely.
And being more experimental, not having a brief, I enjoyed that very much. I don't really like having a brief.
You don't like being told what to do.
That's it. So you know what? It suited me very nicely.
Okay.
And it gave me headspace to do the seeds. So
yeah. And also I suppose it just gives you a bit of time to, you know, as long as you're able to sell your stock, it does give you a bit of time to think about where you want the business to go as well, doesn't it? And like you say, seeds, book, no more weddings.
Yeah, you see, I never would have done all of that. And also on the growing front, you see, when you get so much growing, when you have that much acreage and things go wrong, you don't have time to really stop and think, actually, those peonies are not looking very happy.
Mm.
Not looking very happy. Oh, well, never mind. Now, forget about that. And then you come to the next year and you think, those peonies really are not looking very happy. Oh, I said that last year. Mm. I didn't do anything. And that's what happens. You haven't got time to stop. Well, I did have time to stop. And I actually did, with the peonies, some proper research and talked to peony growers that really know what they're doing and learned what I was doing wrong. Mm. And then spent an eye-watering amount of money on, I don't know how many more, hundreds more peonies. More time to spend money, even though you haven't got it.
Yeah.
On planting more.
I think when I came up to do my course, you mentioned about the peonies then. And is it so you're not going to cut them for, is it 3 years or 5 years?
Yeah. And, you know, it's meant to be 3 years, but don't tell anyone if I do.
Are you? So that actually means they'll be growing and you will not cut them at all?
You're not. Yeah. What happened with my peonies was I was over.
Goodness.
Them. So actually what you're supposed to do is only pick a third to half of the stems on a peony plant. And this is after I left them for 3 years initially after planting.
Oh.
Yeah, I know.
Stop it. How is that even possible in life?
Well,
how
are you I haven't made it possible because you know how it is with weddings and everything else. Yeah. You need those peonies, don't you? So I just exhausted them. And as the peony I spoke to, gosh, who did I speak to? Kate from, this is awful now. She's down in Kent. Anyway, she's an amazing peony grower. She was so helpful. And she said to me, everyone needs to rest sometimes.
Oh.
Which I think, yeah, maybe I feel a bit like a peony, an overpicked peony sometimes.
Well, I think they're just a bit diva, actually, because we don't get them for very long, a year. So, I mean, for goodness sake, at least let them all be cut at once.
They are divas.
They are total divas.
So I had this information from you, Rachel, and I was kind of like, oh, for 3 whole years, really haven't got space. But I was like, no, I love peonies, so I've put 3 beds in.
Yeah, I don't think you will regret it. Not, and especially with your weddings.
Yeah, well.
But what I always found, because I didn't have enough varieties, okay? I only had 4 varieties and, you know, strong pink, white, pale pink, And then inevitably the wedding that wanted the white at that time, only the strong pink was out.
Oh.
So I came to the conclusion that I did need a lot more variety. So in the white, I would have maybe 6 different types of white from early, mid to late season.
Wow.
It's all about hedging your bets.
And with space as well, I suppose.
You need the space.
Yeah.
You know, when people say to me, I'm growing on half an acre, I just think, well, it depends who you, what you're doing, but you're always going to need more space than that. Because the other thing I've learned is that you need to rest ground. That's where I've, you know, the honeymoon period of growing is well and truly over for me. And, you know, all the pests have come and found us, and you need to have ground fallow and resting with green manures on it or whatever. The soil needs time to replenish.
Is there something when you're resting your ground, is there a crop that you grow on it that's basically you're just growing and then you're going to like plow back in?
Yeah, I use green manures a lot. So I might do a sort of clover, red clover, if it's a long-term lay, like it might be 3 years, something like clover is very good. And then we'll use overwintering green manures like rye. Vetch is a really good combination. So it protects the soil. If the soil is not planted, then it needs something on it. So yeah, it's looking after the soil. I mean, that's another reason why perennials are so good, because they're always covering the soil, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah.
Another good reason, another good tick.
There you go.
Well, I'm very pleased that I've planted lots of perennials. So I've probably done about 2/3 foliage and perennials, and then I've got a third that's annuals, but that third is all I've got for this year, really, isn't it? Because the rest of it's going to have to
beef up.
I'm glad I came and did your course, Rachel. I really wish I came and did the whole 3-day season one, but as I said before, I've rushed right in, but it's always
well,
nice.
Well, it's a good start, and actually a lot of people that do the 3-day are people that have already started perhaps a year, and then feel like they need a bit of tweaking.
Time to go back, Jess.
Well, I thought the you know, we all sat down and introduced ourselves at the beginning and said where we were all coming from. There was such a variety, you know. I think there 9 of us on the course, but there was such a variety of people from somebody that had just found gardening through lockdown and her boyfriend had bought her the course so she could see if it was something she wanted to do, to people that had acres and acres of farmland and wanted to diversify, to me that's gone, I was given some land and I've planted it, you know. There was so many different people.
Yeah, it was but you have your market, don't you, because you were already
doing weddings. But yeah. I feel like it's something that's going to need to like change, and you know, the market is something that needs work, but that can only come when I've got flowers to sell, in a way, can't it? We can't sell something when they're still sticking out the ground that far.
Yeah. No, I mean I always think of the flowers as my kind of superpower, and I'm not really confident, and I don't really properly function until I have flowers, a lot of flowers, and then I can do anything, you know, anything's possible. It's such a nice feeling having them all to play with and have ideas from.
One thing I wanted to ask you about as well is, so your photography, you have a lot of your photographs taken by lovely Eva Nemeth, don't you?
I do, yes.
So when did you start having professional photography right from the beginning, or is it something that you kind of at one point met her and were like, right?
Yeah, no, I... quite early on, I think in 2009, we had our first sort of magazine editorial piece where we had a professional photographer. And that's when it dawned on me, because I've been taking pictures, but they were rubbish. That's when it dawned on me that actually, you know, it was quite important to have proper photos. Mm-hmm. And I met another photographer through a course. She came on a course called Claire West. And those were, I worked with her for a year. She just would come every month and take photos. And then we sort of did a few photo shoots together, and because she was a wedding photographer. So we'd do the whole, you know, getting the model and all that stuff. And then I met Eva. I was put together with Eva for a series in House and Garden. House and Gardens. Anyway, it was a sort of, it was a year long growing cut flower series. And I met her and she took the photos for that. And we've, since then, we've sort of worked together on various little bits and bobs, mainly just for fun. I really love Eva's style. She's very popular at the moment, isn't she?
Oh my God. I was looking at her again last night going, oh, I just love her photographs.
And yeah.
The way that she photographs you and your dogs and your garden, it's just perfect for your brand, I suppose, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no, because she's so good at photographing my dog, Jessie. See, so that's really where she's got the in as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. She takes lots of pictures of my dog.
I love that.
No, but she's got such, her shots are very atmospheric. They just fit really well. So yeah, we're working together on the book, which is exciting.
I was going to ask actually, will she be taking the images for your book? We're not allowed to delve too much into it though, are we, about what the subject,
no,
well, we know what the subject, exactly, yeah. Oh, well, we look forward to that.
How long does it take to write and publish a book?
Oh, it's a long job. It probably won't be out till, I think it was spring 2023.
Gosh. Oh my goodness.
I know, everyone will know what to do by then, won't they?
Yeah.
So we'll put two pre-order copies in.
Or yeah, exactly. We'll put orders in now. How do you think it'll be different growing for yourself and your weddings to growing for other florists? How do you think you'll approach that? Will you be driven by what florists ask you for, or will you kind of grow the things you want to grow and hope that the florists will want those? How do you think that'll be different?
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good question, and maybe I should get some feedback. I think what I would like to do is work with a small, you know, selection of florists who are, I presume, are fairly local, because it would be for collection, I think. And then get a feel for their styles and what they like to work with, and probably it probably will work on similar lines, because I mean, I've been doing weddings for so long, I know what's in. You know, I know the colors, the sorts of flowers florists like to work with. I mean, you see it all on Instagram as well, of course. So I think I can probably come up with the goods, but whether I do it, I probably will end up doing it in buckets, arrangers buckets, rather than taking specific stem. I don't think I'll get into stem numbers.
It's a tricky one, that one, isn't it, with the stem numbers?
It is tricky. And I know a lot of florists obviously work that way, don't they? That's how they price.
Yeah.
But because I've had the luxury, really, of never having to count how many stems are in a bouquet, it's just like, oh, we need a bit more, pick some more of that.
Yeah.
I don't really work like that.
No. But how do you work with pricing? How does that work? How would this, I mean, pricing is obviously a major thing for florists and for growers, I think, like especially new growers. How do you work out how much you would sell something for that you've grown?
Well, for me, to be quite honest, it takes about the same effort just to grow all of it, really. So I don't have, I mean, obviously for the farm gate, I have to stem price. Yeah. But I don't really see more value in a branch of eucalyptus to a rose.
Yeah.
In many ways, actually, eucalyptus should be more value. You know,
it takes longer.
It should be cheap, but it takes longer to grow.
Yeah.
So everything has its, it might have been more work on the rose, but it was more time on the shrub. Yeah. So I just do it by labor. I do it by what I think it's worth.
Yeah.
What I think people will pay, what other people are charging. And that's it.
Yeah. No, that's that.
Stems are in anything.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, how do you even go about that? Because you can't go, well, the seed cost me this much, and then blah blah blah. I would find that completely mind blowing on how you would price something.
Well, there are people. Yeah, there are. I mean, like someone like Sel Robertson, she has that system of working from working out the price of things from the
get go.
Labor input, how many stems it produces. But for me, I'm not very good at record keeping, number one. Yeah. But also I sell in such a diverse way that I would never be able to record how many stems a plant produces anyway, because some of it will get picked by someone on Flower Club. Mm. Or, you know, it's all over the shop. So many people are picking my flowers. Yeah. While Belle, you know, she's just, she's picking the flowers and she's selling them to less markets than me. Mm. So I have to go more on what I feel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What I feel is a fair price.
Yeah. I'm so pleased you said that. Just with the, I'm doing another online growing course and I've been looking into pricing, and it seems to be the one thing that nobody is happy to just put the way that they price. Everybody offers another course on pricing or another that. And it seems to be that they're very strict on the record keeping. Like every single thing needs to be, and I am terrible at record keeping. I'm very much a fling it in the ground and see kind of person. So it's very interesting to know as well that there is no right or wrong for pricing. It's what you are happy and what your customers are happy to pay. And that can only come with experience. There's no right or wrong, is there? If you want to do it by stem, but you can
I think the farm gate helps a lot because I'm face to face with customers all the time and I see their response when they see a price on a bucket and I gauge, you know, I read what it, you know, is. Oh, if they're grabbing, if the bucket's empty in 5 seconds, then I know I've touched enough, you know, and you tweak it all the time. Yeah. And you also tweak it depending on when it is in the season. So with your first sweet peas that come out of your tunnel that are premium stems, you obviously charge more for those than you would for the ones that are growing outside a month along, you know, that aren't as good quality and are shorter stemmed and are probably in everyone's gardens. So the prices are always fluctuating just as they are with Dutch auction. And I think you have to be quite tuned in to that. But I would say I'm not very organized. I'm not a very systematic, organized person. I just do it all by how I feel.
Love that.
And, you know, it's obviously worked. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you need to get too hung up.
Best advice I've
heard. Isn't it? Isn't that great? Yeah.
You're telling me exactly what I want to hear.
Good. Yeah. As long as you can, I mean, yeah, we make a good living. We work hard. It's hard work, but we make a good living. I'm not ever going to be rich, but I'm very comfortable and happy. That's fine. And my customers are very happy, you know, because I can see that they think they're getting good value. Not cheap, but it's good.
Yeah,
that's all I want.
God, comfortable and happy and hard work. That sounds good.
It's just finding that sweet spot, isn't it? And it's not always easy. And there's times where I've laid awake at night thinking, God, why did I charge that woman so much money for that bouquet? Oh, that was painful. Or what was I thinking? I thought she gave that away. Mm. You know, so you're gonna have that, and I still have that. This is the thing. People always think, oh, she's been doing it so long, she's got it all right, she's got it all sorted, and that's just not true at all, you know.
But you're comfortable with the way that you're comfortable with the way that you do it and the way that you learn.
I think the thing is, I've accepted there are triumphs, big triumphs, and even bigger failures. You know, that is the life of a flower farmer. And if you can accept, it's accepting that and not letting it get to you and knowing at the end you'll still be all right, then I think it's a good way to go. If you can't deal with that, then it might not be the right thing.
I just need more land. I haven't even had one season.
How much have you got? What's your land?
So I have, I think it's about a third of an acre on the edge of a field. And the agreement is that if I could, with the farmer is my very good friend. And the agreement is if I can make that third of an acre work, then we can add an extra strip. And then we can add an extra strip. Basically, I'm on the side of a 20 acre field. And I keep on joking with him that I have the whole lot of it.
That sounds really good. You've got room to expand.
Well, that's it. That's why he's put me there, and, you know, rather than squeeze into a little corner, because there is room to expand and not taken on too much too soon, because it's just me at the moment. And like you say, it's trial and error, and some things I will love to grow and some things will not like to grow.
So. Yeah, some things will like your land, like your soil. And that's how I started. I probably started with, on that 2 acre, I probably started with about a third of an acre.
Yeah.
And you just gradually grow it out. You just keep going, and you get better at managing it and learning how to grow it efficiently without exhausting yourself.
When you first took over the site, how many of your beautiful kind of shrubs and things did you have to put in?
I didn't have any shrubs.
Okay, so all the hedging is all what you've done.
There was hedging all the way round, which is hawthorn, but there was nothing within the field. And we planted, I spent a hell of a lot of money. We planted a lot of shrubs. And then that winter, it went down to minus 18 and they died. Everything died. Yeah. And so I just planted mint the next year. And I just grew mint, was my only foliage for, a couple of years whilst I recovered from the loss. Like literally thousands of pounds, which I didn't really have because I'd lost everything. So, you know, that's what I mean by extreme failure. Mm. But once I'd kind of got over that, then I went back and I planted more deciduous, because I'd planted a lot of evergreen and it was too cold for where I am. And that's now my mainstay. A lot of these, you know, I put them in as bare root hedging plants very cheaply. So I found a better way.
Yeah.
You know, from that disaster, you kind of go back to the drawing board, don't you? Think, right. Mm. Now I understand the microclimate.
Yeah.
This is what I'm going to do.
Thank you so much for chatting with us, Rachel. We will most certainly be visiting very soon. As soon as those spring summer flowers are out, we're going to come and wander through your garden in our floaty summer dresses and just take photographs of ourselves. It's going to be beautiful.
We really hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Girl Flower Podcast. Please subscribe, share and review on your podcast provider and help us to reach out and connect with other florists, growers and enthusiasts.